All right, well, welcome everybody. Welcome to the June call. I'm talking to you from the Omni Hotel. We're having our June conference today. So for everybody who's back home in your district, thank you for the enormous amount of work you made to make this happen. It's a huge team effort of a combination of the people who can come to the conference and the people who are home this time, but did an enormous amount of work to make this happen. So for the first time in the history of our conference, all 50 states are represented. We have people coming from every single state, and that's over 1,373 people registered. Right now, we have 496 meetings confirmed of a possible 535. So there's a very good chance that we'll hit or exceed the extraordinary number we had last year of 507 meetings. In those 50 states, 40 states have at least one person who identifies themselves as right of center. The group, the work that the Conservative Caucus has done and Jim Tolbert to recruit more people who identify themselves as right of center of the conference is remarkable. 121 total people identify as being right of center at the conference coming this year. We have 205 students. We have 12 Canadians. We have David Michael, our African coordinator, again from Nigeria. With people from Great Britain, from Sweden, and from Panama. We have over 500 people who are new to CCL coming to the conference starting tomorrow. We've got 47 other organizations presenting from a breadth of the Niskanen Center on the right to the Hip Hop Caucus on the left. We have 21 interns. There are 14 regional coordinators, 52 state coordinators, 341 group leaders, 275 liaisons, 371 congressional districts covered by appointments, which is a total of 85% of the entire Congress for people being attended. We have 26 states that have every single one of their congressional districts covered. So we really have a chance to make something very big happen. And for everybody, whether you're here or not, thank you so much for making that happen. I'm going to be introducing our guest from the Environment Voter Project in just a moment. After his comments, I believe that there'll be time to take some questions in the chat, which will be great. Then I'm going to give you, because we're going to be streaming the conference, I'm going to walk through with you some of the things that you might want to pay attention to. So I'll go over when certain talks, certain speakers are speaking, so that if you want to tune in at that time, you'll know when and how to do so. It does feel a little bit funny, honestly, that we're streaming through our Facebook page. To encourage anybody to use Facebook right now does seem a little bit unnerving at the best, but nevertheless, that's the way we've got to go, so that's what we're gonna do. Then we'll go over a couple of updates of things that have happened since last month's call and go over what we're asking everybody to do this month. And again, so let me just introduce our speaker. Nathaniel Stinnett is the founder and executive director of Environmental Voter Project. Their mission is to identify citizens concerned about environmental issues who are staying home on election day and turn them into active voters. He's had a lot of really remarkable positions, both working to getting people elected and in government with senators' offices. And if you read the New York Times on May 27th, the edition two Sundays ago, you saw that he was listed as one of the most important visionaries in the country. So we're very excited that we could get Nathaniel on the call today. Welcome, great to have you, and the floor is yours, Nathaniel.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me, Mark. Can everybody hear me and see the presentation before I get going?
Yep.
Okay. So thank you, Mark. Thank you, Ricky. Just for everybody else who's on the call, both Mark and Ricky told me how inspiring it would be to make sure that I got here early and see everybody sign in from across the country. And boy, were they right. I'm sure I don't need to tell any of you how special Citizens Climate Lobby is, but it is really, really inspiring to me to see all of you taking the time to be so engaged and to lobby on what is obviously an existentially important issue. So thank you. Thank you for what you're doing. I'm going to really value your time. I know I have a short amount of time to make my presentation, and then we're going to have some questions. And so because of that, I am only going to go to a very shallow level on a lot of the stuff that we do, with the understanding that if you want to go deeper on anything, you can bring it up in the question and answer period. And also, I think in a week or two, I'm going to be presenting so that we can go a little bit deeper. On our work. So Let's get started. The Environmental Voter Project is a nonpartisan nonprofit that just does one thing. We identify environmentalists who aren't voting, and we get them to vote more often. So again, to be clear, we don't endorse candidates. We don't lobby people. We don't even try to persuade people to care more about the environment. We just find people who are already persuaded and change their habits. Now, why do we do that? Well, because one of the big reasons that we can't get strong environmental leadership in this country is what you're seeing right here. This is a poll of likely voters that we took leading up to the 2016 presidential election. But I want to be very clear. There is nothing cherry-picked about this poll whatsoever. If you look at people who are likely to vote in any election, it could be a city council race in Boise, Idaho, or president of the United States, or governor in Georgia. When you poll likely voters and ask them not what their preferences are, but what their priorities are, what issues they absolutely care about most, climate change and other environmental issues are almost always towards the bottom. And that has an enormous impact on how policy is made. There are thousands of people on this call, so I'm not going to ask you to actually like raise your hands or speak up, but you can nod. My guess is there are a lot of you who were really frustrated that climate change, that there wasn't a single climate change question asked in any of the presidential debates in 2016. My guess is a lot of you were also pretty frustrated that it didn't come up once in this year's State of the Union address. But you know what? It didn't come up once in the Democratic response to the State of the Union address either. And so what's really important to understand about this is when so few voters prioritize climate change, it impacts policymaking on all sides of the political spectrum. Democrats or Republicans aren't going to pay attention to an issue that voters don't care about. They're just not. And here's why. Campaigns only target likely voters. I know all of us are probably very frustrated by the amount of money that's in politics, and we ought to be. But actually, campaigns have a limited amount of time and a limited amount of money. And so they can really only target the people who are most likely to vote. And in case you guys don't realize this, whether you vote or not is public information. It's public information. Now, rest assured, whom you vote for is secret. That is still secret. But whether you vote or not is public information. So campaigns only target people who vote. And what that means is, of course, they're only going to poll those people. They're only going to poll likely voters. And so that poll that I just showed you, which is like every other poll of likely voters, is not a secret. I'm not revealing like dangerous state secrets here. Every politician who's ever run for anything and polled likely voters for their election knows that voters don't prioritize climate change and other environmental issues. And because of that, it's really hard to expect politicians to prioritize it. Democrat or Republican, liberal or conservative, politicians aren't going to care about an issue that voters don't care about. But, before you despair, let me tell you that there's actually some pretty good news here. We've realized at the Environmental Voter Project that the reason so few voters prioritize climate change is not because too few Americans do. I'll say that again because it's important. The reason so few voters prioritize climate change is not because too few Americans do. There are actually tens of millions of Americans who are registered to vote who list climate change or other environmental issues as either their number one priority or their number two priority. So why aren't these people showing up in polls of likely voters? Because they're not voting. We've realized that the Environmental Voter Project, that environmentalists are disproportionately awful voters. And so there actually might be something close to a green majority in the United States. We're just not showing up a few times each year where it really makes a difference. Because surprise, surprise, politicians don't really care that much about the opinions of non-voters. They care about the people who actually show up on election day. So let me give you some numbers here. We've identified 15.78 million super environmentalists who did not vote in the 2014 midterm elections. And I want to be clear here. All of these people were already registered to vote. They were already registered to vote. And when we say super environmentalists, we mean people who list climate change or some other environmental issue as their number one or number two priority. And they're already registered to vote. They just didn't go out their door on election day. We identified 10.1 million already registered super environmentalists who didn't even vote in the 2016 presidential election, an election that was decided by only 77,000 votes. Now, I'm not claiming that we shouldn't try to persuade people to care more about climate change, nor am I claiming that we shouldn't be doing the great work that you guys do, which is lobbying policymakers to hold their feet to the fire. All of that stuff is extraordinarily important. You're doing God's work. But we also need to recognize that there are people who are already with us, literally tens of millions of them. They are already persuaded. We don't need to twist their arms on anything. They're just not walking out their door on election day. Just to finish up this little part of it, and then I'll get into how we change these people's voting habits, let me give you a little context. There, we have a nice round number of registered voters in the United States right now, 200 million registered voters. About 83 million people voted in the 2014 midterm elections. Only 4.2 million of them are what we would call super environmentalists, people who list these issues as their number one or number two priority. Those four little green squares there, they're not going to convince politicians to do anything. They're just not. Politicians go where the votes are. That might sound cynical, but it's not. It's just, it's arithmetic. It's how elections work. Politicians go where the votes are, or they don't get to be politicians anymore. And when only 4.2 million out of 83 million people showing up list climate change or some other environmental issue as a top two priority, that's not going to get any politician to do anything. In 2016, there were about 136, actually 137 million people who voted, and environmental turnout was a little bit better. We had about 10.1 million people who list climate change or the environment as their number one or number two priority vote. But still, that's a really small percentage. It's about 7.5% of the electorate. You see that group up there? That's 10 million super environmentalists who didn't even show up for a presidential election. They're already registered to vote, but they didn't even show up. And at the Environmental Voter Project, what we do is we don't try to turn any of these blue squares green. We're not in the persuasion business. Nor are we trying to get these people to vote for particular candidates. I don't need to tell anybody on this call or in any of the rooms around the country, there are great groups that already do that, who endorse candidates and persuade people to vote for the best environmentalists, and they do great work, and we're not trying to do that. All we do is we identify these environmentalists who aren't voting, and we try to push them into the electorate. We're in the habit-changing business, not the mind-changing business. And when we go into a particular state, once we identify these super environmentalists, we view every election as an opportunity to start changing their habits. Because, as I said earlier, and this is so important to understand, if there is one thing you take away from this call, let it be this. Whether you vote or not is public record. It's public record. And the first thing any politician does before starting their campaign is look at public voter files and decide, okay, which of these people are we going to talk to and which of them are we not going to talk to? And surprise, surprise, they only talk to the people who have a really high likelihood of voting. And surprise, surprise, those are the only people whose opinions they care about. And that shouldn't surprise us. It's no different from any other aspect of our lives. We wouldn't expect Starbucks to care about us if we don't drink coffee. We wouldn't expect Ford Motor Company to try to market a car to a three-year-old who can't even drive. Why on earth would politicians care about us if there's a public record showing that we never, ever, ever vote? And so at the Environmental Voter Project, we view every election as an opportunity to start turning people into better voters, even if it's for library trustee or district attorney, things that seemingly have no impact on climate change or the environment whatsoever. So very quickly, and I'm not going to go into detail here because I know we have a very small amount of time, how do we do this? We essentially do three things. We use a lot of publicly available data off of public voter files to identify people who don't just care about climate change and the environment, but as I said, listed as one of their top two priorities. And then the best part is we can bypass the most expensive part of politics, which is persuading people to change their minds, which in this weird post-fact world is almost impossible. No, we already know these people are with us. So at that point, we can concentrate on whatever messaging gets them out the door on election day. Hell, we would talk about chocolate chip cookies at this point if it got these people to vote. And then, once we do start getting them to vote, we reinforce their habits until we're confident that they're good enough voters that campaigns and endorsement groups will be targeting them. Very quickly, how do we do this? We canvass, we call, we text, we send direct mail, we do digital outreach. And really interestingly, the messaging we use is not only nonpartisan, it's completely apolitical. The Environmental Voter Project doesn't even talk about the environment for a very good reason. It doesn't work. Now, mind you, it's a very good way to convince people to care more about climate change. I'm not saying you guys at CCL should stop talking about climate change, but the Environmental Voter Project, when we've found someone who's already with us and the only thing we're trying to do is get their rear ends out the door on election day, well, we've found the most impactful way to do that is to use peer pressure and social pressure. We simply say things like, hey, did you know last time there was an election, 93 people on your street voted? Or we get people to promise to vote and then right before the election, follow up with them and remind them that they made a promise. And then sometimes we even remind them, hey, whether you vote or not is public information, so we're going to know whether you follow through on your promise. And that might sound a little heavy-handed, but boy, does it work. And I don't need to convince any of you guys on this call that we're not dealing with a small problem here. We're dealing with a truly existential crisis. And if this is what it takes to get our people to vote, well, we're going to do it. So, finally, I'm not going to go through our results, but you can go to our website and look at some of our reports. We're at environmentalvoter.org. We submit all of our work to randomized control trials, and we're sending turnout through the roof. Through the roof. We're currently in six states: Nevada, Colorado, Georgia, Florida, Pennsylvania, and Massachusetts. These are states where we're spending money to mobilize these people. But in all 50 states, if people sign a pledge promising to vote and always prioritize climate and the environment, we will send them free election reminders before every election they've got, even dog catcher and library trustee races. So, to finish, it's really, really important for all of us, obviously, to continue your outstanding work at Citizens Climate Lobby. But we also need to start viewing the act of voting as one of the highest forms of environmental citizenship. And I know I'm preaching to the choir here. By definition, you guys are politically engaged. But you need to understand that our friends and neighbors and colleagues who say that they care about climate change and say that they care about the environment, I'm not claiming they're lying. I'm sure that they do. But they often express themselves in apolitical ways. They might change their eating habits or their energy consumption habits or the way that they get to work. But chances are they're not voting. Environmentalists, by and large, are disproportionately awful voters. So chances are your climate friends don't show up as often as they should. And so we need to keep that in mind this election year. What can you do? Well, the first thing is, if you want to sign up for that voter pledge, we will send you free election reminders before every single election. Or if you have kids who aren't very good at remembering to vote, sign them up and we'll send them election reminders. We'll email them. We'll even send them text messages if they want. And the second thing is, be a loud and proud environmental voter. Take it from someone who spends all of his time bathing in the behavioral science of getting someone to vote. Peer pressure works. We might think that we like graduated from fourth grade, but the truth is we're all still in middle school and peer pressure works. If your friends know that the act of voting is one of the most important ways that you express yourself as someone who cares about climate change, that will rub off on them. Peer pressure works. It works. I'll close by just saying this. Please, 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 by no means walk away from this call and this meeting saying, oh man, this Nathaniel Stinnett guy said environmentalists aren't voting and this is awful news and the world is going to end. No, this is great news, guys. This is really, really hopeful because changing minds is so hard. It is so hard, especially around climate change. And so if I told you we had polled millions of Americans and it turns out no one cares about climate change, that would be bad news. But that's not what we found. We found the opposite. We found that there are tens of millions of Americans who care so deeply about this issue, they list it as one of their top two priorities. They're just not voting. They're not voting. And changing people's habits, changing their behavior, I won't claim it's easy, but boy, is it a heck of a lot easier than changing their minds. And so we have this enormous opportunity here. We have this silent green majority who, if we just started showing up on election day, we could change everything. We could change everything. And I'll close by saying this. We could change everything on both sides of the aisle because there is nothing, nothing that motivates a politician more than the prospect of winning or losing an election. And politicians go where the votes are. It's that simple. They go where the votes are. There's something that you guys have on your website that I love. It says, governments will respond to the will of the people, provided we tell them what we want. And you're right. You're absolutely right. But there's a little caveat. Whether you vote or not is public record. And so politicians don't necessarily pay attention to the non-voters as much as they pay attention to the voters. And so we've got to vote. We've got to vote like it's our job this year and every year. So thank you. I think I went a little bit over, but
it's okay.
Thank you guys.
Yeah, so Nathaniel, we'll see if we have time to get to some questions in the chat. Ricky, I think you need to mute your line over there. Thank you. But there were a couple of pre-questions that came in that I want to get to. How many times does it take for a non-voter to start voting to become habitual, where they don't need support, they don't need help? You know, now it's just one of the things they do. Like, I would never not vote. That just wouldn't happen. How many times does it take voting before that happens with them?
So that's a great question. And a lot of it depends on which elections they vote in. Mm-hmm. So what we know is voting is a sticky habit. It is absolutely a sticky habit. You vote once, regardless of the election, you are sometimes 40, even 50% more likely to vote in the next election, even if no one ever talks to you again. But what I meant by it depends on the election is, let's say the first time I vote is in a presidential election. Well, then 6 months later, if someone's running for city council, they're not going to assume that I'm likely to vote in that city council race. Because tons of people vote for president, but very few people vote for city council. But if the first time I vote is for a down-ticket kind of sleepy election, like a city council race or a library trustee election, well, it only takes 2 months for the record of me having voted to show up on the public voter file. And then, Mark, the cavalry comes in. Because then everybody running for governor or U.S. Senate says, Oh my God, Nathaniel, he voted at a city council race. If he's crazy enough to vote for city council, of course he's going to vote for governor. And then they start spending all of their time and money and efforts coming after me, figuring out what issues I care about. So it depends a little bit on the type of election that you vote in. I wish I could give you a black and white answer, but that's sort of the nuances of how campaigns look at it.
Okay, I think the next question will be a little bit hard to give a black and white answer also, but let's take a shot at it.
Great.
Why is it that environmentalists are such disproportionately bad voters?
You're absolutely right. That is an outstanding question, and I'm going to give you a nuanced, but unfortunately probably unsatisfying answer. The honest answer is we don't know. Mm-hmm. It's very easy for behavioral scientists to set up an experiment to figure out why people take an action. So if I give you a $1 coupon, it might not be enough for you to buy a product, but a $2 coupon is. So it's really easy for us to figure out how to get people to take actions. What's really hard is to do the opposite. It's really hard to figure out why people don't take an action. The best thing you can do, actually really the only thing you can do, is to ask them. Is to poll them. And so not only we, but lots of people have polled voters and asked them, hey, when you don't vote, what are your reasons for not voting? And we learn a lot of really interesting things. The first thing that we learn is people lie their pants off when you ask them about their voting habits. The overwhelming majority of non-voters will lie and say that they vote all the time. And again, I know I sound like a broken record here, but it's so important. Who you vote for is secret, but whether you vote or not is public record. So when people tell us that they vote all the time, as long as we know their name, which we do if we're polling them, we can look at their public voting record and see whether they're telling the truth or not. And they are lying all the time. And I won't get into the details, but there are a whole lot of other studies that have been done that show it's really hard to figure out why people aren't voting. Yeah. But I just want to say one more thing, and that's this. When people lie and say that they vote more often than they do, that's really interesting. Not because it tells us why they're not voting, but it actually gives us a clue as to the best way to get them to vote. And that's this. We have realized that even people who don't vote still buy into the societal norm that voting is a good thing. In fact, they buy into it so much that they'll lie their pants off to a stranger on the phone swearing up and down that they vote all the time. And that is why peer pressure and social pressure works. Because we still want to be known as good voters. And so again, that's why you guys got to be loud and proud about voting.
Great. And so if you could answer this one quickly, because we have to move to the next part of the call. So a lot of the people are out canvassing right now, and they want to know what can they do to, you know, that would help people actually get out and vote with if they're canvassing now.
Right. So again, I want to be clear that there are kind of two parts of canvassing. One that people often do in political campaigns is persuasion, which is you're trying to persuade people to vote for a particular candidate or to care about a particular issue. And that is not what we do at the Environmental Voter Project. We find people who are already persuaded. But then to get to your question, Mark, if someone's already persuaded and you're simply trying to get them out the door on election day, one of the best things you can do and one of the easiest things, because it's completely apolitical and nonpartisan, trap them. Mm-hmm. Get them to say that they're going to vote. Get them to say that they're going to vote and figure out some way to remind them of the fact that they said it. Because that's another societal norm that we all buy into. All of us, no matter how often we lie, all of us want to be viewed as being honest and trustworthy people. And so if you get someone to say that they're going to vote and then reminds them that they said that, it sends their likelihood of voting through the roof. So that's one of the easiest things you can do to get someone to vote.
Fantastic. Well, listen, this is fantastic, absolutely perfect information for our people. I'm sure a lot of them will sign up and also figure out everything they can do to help you to, it's all in our best interest for you to succeed.
Well, it's in everybody around the world's best interest for you guys to succeed too. It's an honor to be a part of your work, even in this small way. So thank you.
Great. Yeah, thank you. And you're welcome to stay on. I know you've got little kids, but if you want to stay on for the next few minutes as we review what we're going to be doing and what's going to be happening at the conference, you're welcome to. But I understand it's a weekend and your kids are little. So thank you, Nathaniel. Okay, good. What I'm going to do is I'm going to review part of the conference schedule and just go over some of the things that will be streamed. So for those of you, I would imagine that for most of the people on the call, you're not going to be able to get here between now and wherever you are and tomorrow morning. So I want to review with you what is happening so you could see what would be screened. I mean, what would be shared. And now it's what is being shared is going to be on the screen. Excellent. What's going to happen is tomorrow morning, there'll be opening comments for 45 minutes. That's going to be streamed and you're welcome to join for the West Coast. That's 6 o'clock. That might be a little bit early. And then at 10:15, we break into three sessions, a new climate advocate training for over 500 people, a group leader and liaison session, and then there'll be various breakout sessions. Okay. So then at 2 o'clock, this part is important. And I do recommend that you figure out how to be there at 2 o'clock East Coast time. What we're going to be doing is walking through with you our way forward, our legislative strategy, our planning strategy. So that session is hosted by Madeline Pera, our Vice President of Programs. Danny Richter will be sharing our legislative strategy. Many of you probably know Tony Cerna in the role of IT director, but he's also our strategy coordinator and has really moved into a strategy role in the organization. And so he'll be outlining our strategy. And again, whether you're live at the conference or in the distance, I think you're going to want to hear that. One of our newest staff members that you probably haven't met, Jamie DeMarco, will be going over our state-level carbon pricing coordinator, what they're doing. So if you were on our call in December of 2016, you remember that one of the things we said is with a new administration coming in, we believe that the leverage of the Clean Power Plan was gone for us. Because what we've been saying for years is, if you don't like regulation, then here's a market-based alternative you can offer. Without that, we needed additional leverage. So what we did is we set up some criteria for evaluating where we would work on states, not just for the emission reductions you could get in that state, but also for what it would do to increase pressure for the federal government to act so that particularly business didn't have to function under 10 or 20 sets of rules. And then we'll be getting an international update from Kathy Orlando. So if you follow our Twitter or our blog or our newsletters, you'll see that all kinds of interesting organizing has been happening. And so we've had a lot of recent chapters that have started in Africa where the internet signal isn't even strong enough for us to be able to do it by Zoom. So we've done some starts by WhatsApp, and we're doing one of those in French. Thank goodness Kathy's bilingual. So one of the French-speaking countries in Africa will be doing that in French. So Kathy will be giving us an international update, and we'll be excited about that. Sunday night we'll be streaming, and Sunday night is Danny Richter and his team. So Danny will be doing the presentation, but the remainder of his team, Stephanie Doyle, Andres Jimenez, Ben Pendergrass, Jay Butera will all be there. And Danny will be, in addition to building on the legislative strategy he gave us in the afternoon, preparing us for being on the Hill on Tuesday, being successful with our primary asks, our secondary asks. So essentially, this is us being ready to go. That gets us over to Monday. Now, if you're on the West Coast, I do recommend you get up early for Marshall's kickoff of the conference. I think a lot of us always look forward to Marshall's comments. And what he's going to be doing on Monday morning is giving Jim Hansen an award for 30 years of extraordinary work. And wherever you are in the country, I recommend that you get that. Now, if it just doesn't work for you at 6 o'clock in the morning on the West Coast, we will record everything we're streaming. So if you miss it live, you'll get a chance to hear it later. So after that introduction and award to Dr. Hansen, the initial kickoff panel is Dr. Jane Hansen, our country's leading climate scientist. Along with him is Adele Morris, who is kind of the economist of Washington, D.C. Anytime you talk about something regarding economics, everybody says, what does Adele think? So she's her voice matters a lot in D.C. And then Dr. Natasha D. Jarnett, you've heard her on our monthly call before. She did a breakout session at last year's conference. Her area of expertise is climate change as it applies to public health, a very important voice. And then the last member of that panel, Trishna Goering from the Ocean Conservancy, really what she's going to be emphasizing on her session is communications, that she's an expert on communication on climate change, and that will really be what her comments are on. The second panel in the morning is going to be Ted Halstead. Oops, there we go, backwards one. Oh, missing a slide maybe? Okay. All right, well anyway, there's a second breakout, which is gonna be Ted Halstead and Students for Dividends. So the student leader from Harvard or Yale will be there with along with Ted for the second breakout session in the morning. And then after that, to wrap up the morning session, is going to be our very own Leslie Beatty, who's going to be walking us through our branding and marketing effort. It has been a really remarkable thing for our organization, for somebody who understands how branding and marketing works, to look at things we're doing and see how they could be positioned and focused better. And I think that you're going to want to hear that, because she's doing some really nice work that I believe gives us the best chance at success over the long haul. Then we'll have breakout sessions from 1:30 to 5. There will be a breakout session that will be streamed during all of those, so you'll be able to watch the breakout sessions. And then the closing plenary is going to be Representative Delaney from Maryland. He's a member of the Climate Solutions Caucus, and that starts at 5:15. We will not be streaming the dancing, so we'll spare you that. And then we'll be on the Hill all day Tuesday and have a reception back here at the hotel. One of the things that's going to be really important is at the reception back at the hotel, many years, and we'll try to do that again this year, is have people who, this is their first time at CCL, share about what their experience was like being on the Hill. And it's important that all of us who are going to be on the Hill on Tuesday know that those meetings are confidential. So it's important to share how excited we are. It's important to how to share our experience, but it's important also that we keep the details and who those meetings were with private. Okay, just a couple of highlights I want to mention that happened since last month's call, then I'll go over what we're doing this month. Dave Folland, the co-lead for Salt Lake City, published his 100th letter to the editor. 100 letters to the editor from one person. That's just really cool. That's one of 291 pieces that were published this month. So congratulations to Dave and everybody in Salt Lake. You know, one of the things the Salt Lake chapter instituted years ago, and it's really helped their overall effort, is they have a writing group. So people work on each other's writing, they give each other coaching, they write with each other, and Dave's 100th letter is fantastic. Also, Austin, we got the city of Austin to endorse carbon fee and dividend. So that's so far this year, one of 94 state, county, and municipal resolutions. So congratulations for the people in Texas who got the Austin resolution. Okay, so what are we doing this month besides the seeing over 500 people on the Hill on Tuesday? Well, in Canada, we're focusing on two things, outreach efforts and also preparing for the Ottawa conference. It's amazing. There are 12 people coming down from Canada for this conference, and we'll be having our own conference in Ottawa in October. In the U.S., we're asking you to write letters and op-eds about the CCL International Conference. Wherever you can include the theme of bipartisanship, we would really appreciate that. And then also plan your summer outreach with CCL in your beach bag. So plan your events for how you can do outreach to grow your chapters. The laser talk is about bipartisanship. Okay, now I want to say something to everybody for a second, and that is the last couple of months, quite a few chapters have stayed on after the call to wave goodbye, and then the camera will spotlight your chapter. So if you've never done that, we can't get to every chapter, but it seems like every month we've been able to get to like 20 or 30 chapters. Ricky will unmute the lines, but then you probably want to remute yours so you don't get a screeching. But it's been really nice just to connect with people, not just as the call begins as we're starting, but also as we're waving goodbye. And maybe you want to, if you're not coming to DC, cheer the people on who are going to be on the Hill on Tuesday. So Ricky, if you could unmute the lines for a minute and let the camera go where it goes.
Hi.